Jonathan Edwards, the 18th century American preacher, I'm afraid, not the great triple jumper. Jonathan Edwards had a wife called Sarah and a daughter who was also called Sarah, which doesn't strike me as very clever, but there we go. Confusion in that house. Daughter Sarah had a fearsome temper. All the same, one day a young man called Elihu Parsons. Did mums and dads get up to in those days? A young man called Elihu Parsons wanted to marry her, and Edwards felt that he had to warn him about this temper. And when he'd finished giving his warning, Parsons said to Edwards, "But she has grace, I trust." To which Edwards said, "I hope so, but grace can live where you cannot." You've got to know what someone's like if you're going to live in relationship with them, haven't you? And we've got to know what God is like if we're going to live in relationship with Him. It's just the nature of things that many of us over the coming months will find that walking with God will take us into new areas. And many of us will find it will take us into exactly the same areas as we've been treading. For months, maybe years before. We're not likely to come face to face with a burning bush, but we do need to know what sort of God is the God of the bush. And I want tonight just to briefly sketch in five truths about the God of the bush. Not cold facts, just warm truths. And if you feel at this stage of the day a five-course meal is a little bit heavy, take this encouragement that, you know, if you kind of doze in the middle of a course, it's not long before you can wake up and pick up that we're on to the next one and you can catch us up again. Here's truth number one. The God of the bush is a God with a people. Come back to chapter 3 and to verse 4. And when the Lord saw that Moses had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, "Moses, Moses." And Moses said, "Here I am." "Don't come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy ground." Now, this God, who at first sight seems unapproachable, it's this burning bush, it's the voice from within, it's "don't you come any closer and get your shoes off," actually turns out to be a God with a people. See how he goes on, verse 6. He said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." The covenant God, the God we were seeing last night who makes and keeps promises, the God who has a history with his people, he has a God with a record, he has been faithful to his people. This is the God you can trust. When we were living in Mile End and the kids were young and there was a stage when there was we had three under three, Julia Weber, some of you may just remember her, who used to come over once or twice a week just to help Claire looking after the kids. And one day she turned up a good 45 minutes later than she said she was coming. And she explained she just got to turning into the square and she remembered. She had promised Lucy, our middle child, that she would bring something that day and realized she'd left it at home. So she turned round, went back home, picked it up and came back. It was a good 45-minute trip because she said, "I'd promised and I wanted her to know that you could rely on a promise." That's impressive, isn't it? Well, if this God makes a promise, you can rely on it. Which is a good thing, because we New Testament Christians rely on some very old promises. I've got a friend back home in Sheffield, and he's just the kind of person whom Richard Weston rides his bike to meet. because he gets involved with a number of internationals in the city. And he was round at some Chinese friends having a meal at their place. And on the way out, by the door, he was just admiring a picture. And it was full of, you know, it was a kind of Chinese-type picture and Chinese writing at the bottom. And he was about to ask what this was, because, of course, it meant absolutely nothing to him. All the hieroglyphics, when he suddenly saw in brackets at the end of the Chinese writing, there was just 3:16. And all of a sudden he was fluent in Chinese. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. It's 2,000 years old, that promise. And we're still leaning on it. It still holds. That's the God Moses is meeting in the bush. Now, why is God telling Moses this? Well, not just to remind him that he's listening to a God he can rely on. He's also telling Moses it to identify himself. A strange voice, a strange bush, could be anyone, couldn't it? No, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, you don't have to be the greatest Bible historian to know that Abraham, Isaac and Jacob are long gone by the time we reach Exodus chapter 3. They were figures of history, and yet they live on. See, God wasn't the God whom Abraham worshipped, though he did worship him. He's the God Abraham belonged to. Years and years later, when Jesus is engaging in debate with some pretty sceptical religious types of his day called the Sadducees, who did not go a bundle on anything much beyond this life, and they tried Jesus out with a fancy question about a guy who marries someone and she dies, and you know, they all sort of marry and marry and marry and marry, and when you get to heaven, you know, who are going to be the partners there? The whole thing is ridiculous, isn't it? Jesus actually quotes this. He confronts these skeptics when it comes to the resurrection and says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. Belong to him and you're forever his. Not even death will break this. Will break this relationship with God. You don't fade into history. Some of you will have known Ann Taylor, who died last week. Was it the week before? We had her funeral on Thursday. You know, God isn't saying, I was the God of Ann Taylor. I am the God of Ann Taylor. Just a couple of days before she died, she said to a close friend, heaven is very near now. Death wasn't going to be the end. Her mum and dad are up in Sheffield. They actually lost their other daughter, their only other child, last year to cancer as well. One of those real tragic deaths. I married her one week and buried her the next. And I was talking with them last week. And we were just talking. I mean, they have a remarkable faith. It's very realistic. There's no sort of pie in the sky as if nothing tragic has happened. And yet they said, as they were facing up to the loss of Anne, they said, eternal life's all we've got, isn't it? It's the only thing that makes sense of this. Their trust is still in the God who is the God of Ann Taylor. The God with a people he doesn't let go of. Second truth about this God. He's the God with a heart. You'll find this in verses 7 to 12 of chapter 3. The God with a heart. Sven Goran Eriksson is not a good model of God's management style. Not a good model of one or two other things as well, but his ice-cool image, at least, is not a good model of God's management style. this image that has him sort of distanced from all the heat and passion of battle, at times seemingly even remote. Listen to what God's like. Very different. Verse 7, the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and the home of various ites. There's a Christian magazine that's got a wonderful cartoon of a clergyman. He's on the phone. He's clearly listening to a call that's full of some complaint about him. And he's checking his records as he listens. And he's saying on the phone, impersonal? In what way, Jones, Mr. Henry M? Well, passion and compassion is actually a mark of this God. There's a passion and a compassion about some Christians that lands them in trouble sometimes and sends them wrong sometimes, but also puts them into people's lives sometimes, genuinely in among the hurts and the pains and the heartaches, and there is something godly in that. I've indeed heard the misery of my people, so I have come down to rescue them. See, do see this in the God of the bush. And even if you haven't guessed where it's leading, you can't be too surprised when you read later of how God showed himself in Jesus. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, the writer to the Hebrews says, because he's come down among us, stood in our shoes. And if we've understood the God of the bush, when we get to those lines, we say, of course, that fits, it's typical. Just like the God of the bush. You see how he goes on in verse 10, 9. Now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go, I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Oh, it's not just a kind of Brit humility type sentence. I mean, here is a man who really is saying, who am I? I'm someone, I've had a go at this already and been a failure. Who am I to go? I'm the one whose wanted poster is up all over Egypt. Verse 12, God said, I will be with you. Well, of course he did. I mean, this God doesn't face the hurt and then step back and send someone else. This God won't look danger in the face and step back and send a minion instead. When this God's going to say to another group of followers, go into all the world and make disciples of all nations, well, he's going to add, I'm with you till the end of the age. Yeah, the God with a people is a God with a heart. And he's going to be saying some goes to you and to I, but as he says them, he's saying, I am with you. Then thirdly, he's the God with a name. And that's verses 13 to 22. See, when in verse 13 Moses says to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what's his name? Then what shall I tell them? It isn't really asking for a bit of ID. you know, have you got a driving license or a credit card? Anything we can check your name on, sir? Name means character. What's he like? What kind of God are you? Moses is saying. And God said to Moses, I am who I am. That's what you're to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. And if you're scratching your heads over I am who I am and wondering if that's a lot of use, do understand it is precisely the kind of phrase that gets you endless PhDs, and I don't know how much ink spilt on the words. It's very hard not to be confused. So let me just give you a few pointers. Firstly, it's saying this, I exist. Compared with all the idols that are scattered around, and we'll see tomorrow night that the clash of the gods is just over the page. He's saying, I am present here with you. I am who I reveal myself to be. I am, well, really, it's as much I am who I will be. It's the same kind of phrase as was there back in verse 12 when God said, I will be with you. You want to know what I'm like, says God? Well, keep watching this space. Stay tuned to history. You say, no, look, please just give me a straight black and white answer, can't you? Now, we love to have God all nicely boxed up, don't we? A neat, identical picture. It's not the way he comes. You know, you'll know what God's like when you've seen him in action. When you've heard him speak. I will be what I will be. And if it's an echo of verse 12, he's really saying, I'll be present with you to be whatever I need to be for you in the circumstances. What does Moses need? What do the people need? Is it compassion? Well, look at verse 16. Go assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me and said, I have watched over you and have seen what has been done to you in Egypt. Is it hope? Well, look at verse 17. I promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt into a land flowing with milk and honey. Is it muscle? Well, look at verse 19. I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptian with all the wonders that I'll perform among them, and after that he'll let you go. What's his name? What do I tell people? What are you like, God? Well, God said to Moses, verse 14, I am who I am. God said to Moses, verse 15, say to the Israelites, the Lord has sent me to you. And it's utterly lost on us in English, translation you've got and version you've got. But the Hebrew clearly links that word, the Lord, to that phrase in verse 14, I am who I am. And if your eyes are good enough to read the footnotes, whether you've got the NIV or the ESV, it points it out there. That word, Yahweh, Jehovah, shortened, packed all into the one word, everything that's meant by verse 14. This is my name forever, he says. The name by which I'm to be remembered from generation to generation. So don't let people reduce the idea of Yahweh to some kind of scholarly snobbery or nonsense. You know, a name, a character, is a key to a personality, isn't it? Often is. We give people nicknames for that reason, don't we? You know, Lofty, Smiley, the glum ones, Brains. It's the name by which God wants to be known for all time. The name to meet my deepest emotional needs. What do you need God to be? That actually is him. Yahweh. I'll be present to be whatever I need to be for you in the circumstances. I was reading a book once called Mortal Lessons, Notes in the Art of Surgery, which doesn't sound terribly riveting. Well, to be quite honest, I've read one story from this book, and it's a great story. And it's a wonderful illustration of this idea of I'll be what you need me to be in the situation. It's the story of a surgeon who was performing surgery to remove a tumour from a young woman's face, and to do it, he had to sever a facial nerve, which meant that her mouth was permanently twisted. And he goes on to talk about a time he was by her bedside afterwards as she was recovering. And here's what he says. Her young husband is in the room. He stands on the opposite side of the bed, and together they seem to dwell in the evening lamplight, isolated from me, private. Who are they, I ask myself. He and this wry mouth I've made, who gaze at and touch each other so generously, greedily. The young woman speaks. Will my mouth always be like this? She asks. Yes, I say, it will. It's because the nerve was cut. She nods and is silent. But the young man smiles. I like it, he says. It's kind of cute. And all at once, I know who he is. I understand. I lower my gaze. And he bends to kiss her crooked mouth. And I so close can see how he twists his own lips to accommodate hers, to show her that their kiss still works. I will be what you need me to be. That's the God of the bush. The God with a people. The God with a heart. The God with a name. The God with power. That's the first dozen verses of chapter 4. Now, if you had your suspicions that God was keener on this plan than Moses, well, they're growing as we head into chapter 4. Moses answered, what if they don't believe me or listen to me and say the Lord did not appear to you? I can't work out whether Moses is really worried what the Israelites are going to say, or whether this is just his doubts surfacing. You know, in that kind of time-honored phrase where someone confidentially says to you, I have a friend who... And you're never quite sure whether it's really third person or first person. I mean, after all, poor Moses is the point man. And if you think about it, just sympathize with him for a moment. The only sign he's really been given so far is back in chapter 3 and verse 12. I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who've sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you'll worship God on this mountain. How will I know I'm going to do it? Well, when you've done it, you'll know you've done it. You know, I mean... Great, thanks a million, Lord. A few more signs like that and we're all home, aren't we? So God gives him some signs to validate the message. Verses 2 to 5, it's the staff that becomes the snake and then goes back again. They sort of sound like kind of David Copperfield conjuring tricks to us, but there's more to them than that. The snake is the symbol of Egyptian royal authority. And Moses is going to take it by the tail and control it. Well, then in verses 6 and 7, there's the hand that goes into the cloak and comes out diseased and then goes back in and is restored. And Moses is going to lead the unclean nation to be cleansed. And then in verses 8 and 9 there's the water into the blood, which is not so much a sign, more the first plague. Blood is a sign of both life and death, isn't it? And that's what's going to happen when God acts through Moses. It's going to be life for Egypt's slaves and death for Egyptian slave drivers. Moses and the Israelites can go in the confidence that God's mighty hand's with them, though Moses isn't convinced. Actually, of course, see, signs and miracles are never as long-term convincing as we always imagine they are, or they will be. Now, some of you have been around long enough and have seen some of these signs and realized how a few years later people are always having to come back for more. It's why Jesus was always so wary of them. Now, you didn't score high marks with Jesus if you came asking for a few signs and miracles. And so Moses comes back to him again in verse 10. Moses said to the Lord, "O Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you've spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue." See, here's Moses saying, look, I'm not up to it, God. You know, you kind of sense that there's more to it than just that, don't you? The guy's just been given a bag full of tricks, and now he says, I'm not up to it. But watch God's answer. It's very revealing. Look at verse 11. The answer is not, "You are, Moses." It's not, "Oh no, Moses, you've got yourself wrong. You're actually a very good speaker, really. You know, I love listening to you." That's the kind of route, I confess, I often take, too often take that option. I think, you know, you'll hastily reassure the person straight away. There's nothing flattering in verse 11, is there? The Lord said to him, "Who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Isn't it I, the Lord?" "Well, I'm not up to it, God, you know, really. I'm not much of a speaker." This is your Creator speaking. The one who puts you together and knows exactly how your mouth works. Who do you think is going to be doing the work? "I will help you. Now go. I will help you speak and will teach you what to say. I'll be for you whatever I need to be for you in the circumstances." It's a great lesson. It explains why some of the smoothest talkers get absolutely nowhere in gospel ministry. And some of the roughest speakers are greatly used by God. See, if we forget that it is the God who made us, who's behind it all, you know, we get ourselves into terrible straits. Leadership has become a growth industry, as far as I can see. There are books galore being written about it. In fact, I've just been sent one by a friend who's asking me to write some nice little strap line. I wish I learnt the lesson from Dick. If you ever read Dick's cover notes on books, they're wonderful. You get about four or five other people who say, "This is the best book I've read for years on the subject, William Taylor. This is..." stimulated me hugely and has revolutionized my ministry, Hugh Palmer. And then Dick writes, "Anything by David Jackman is well worth reading." I kind of think it would save myself reading all the way through this manuscript. Why don't I just pen that? That'll be great. So this is one of the... Apparently books on leadership have multiplied 300-fold between 1975 and 1995 or something or other. Hey, here's one of the great things that too many of them miss out completely. If I ignore the fact of God, the Creator God behind things, we'll reduce everything to stereotypes, won't we? The only leader we want is the one who fits the image that we've already got. If the only other alternative we get is people who will go anywhere and will actually have ignored the God who's behind them, the God who makes them. can be hugely radical and have left God out. Oh, I'm not up to this. This is your Creator speaking. Go and I'll be with you. Whatever I need to be for you in the circumstances. Here's the God with a people. You can trust his promise. The God with a heart. I've come down to rescue. The God with a name. I'll be whatever I need to be for you. The God with power. I'll help you speak. Ah, I said there were five. This is also the God with anger. Verses 12 to 17. Now go, verse 12. Verse 13, but Moses said, O Lord, please send someone else to do it. Yeah, it just rings sort of all wrong right from the beginning. It's like the pianist who plays the wrong chord, isn't it? You know, the dancer who misses his step. And it's not as if it's particularly intricate syncopation, is it? It's now go, Lord, please send someone else. But it's not humility now, it's disobedience. See, humility isn't thinking poorly of ourselves or, you know, that British version of it, which is we must always say we're not bad if we're very good. Humility is thinking nothing of myself and everything of God. I remember one guy who had been asked to take on a leadership responsibility, he came to talk it over with me, and he said, I really don't think I can do it. I said, why on earth not? Well, he said, I don't think I'm up to it. I knew him quite well. He's perfectly well up to it. And I confess I was feeling slightly sort of terse and fed up and thought this was a slight bit of false humility. So I just said to him, well, look, don't take it when you think you are up to it. Oh, Lord, please send someone else to do it. Then the Lord's anger burned against Moses. His anger. But of course, it's the other side of the coin from love, isn't it? Have we got a God with a heart? Yes, the kind of heart that sees injustice and comes down to do something about it, that cares that passionately. Well, what do you expect to find? When he's promised rescue, he's met the fears one by one. Who am I? What shall I tell them? What if they don't believe me? I'm slow of speech. Every one of them met. And then he says, please send someone else. Moses, Moses, said the voice from the bush. Here I am. Please send someone else. Well, don't be surprised if there's anger then. Not because his plan is thwarted. It isn't, of course. Aaron's already on his way there. But his anger comes because of Moses' disobedience. And when God, in his anger, gives us what we want, that gift rarely turns out to be the blessing we imagine. Aaron would later lead the people of God in all kinds of damaging ways. But for all of that, Moses is not out of the plot. And though Aaron's there, and though Aaron's given as the answer to Moses' disobedient hesitancy, just as Moses is about to slip away, you notice verse 17, God just reminds him, take the staff in your hand so you can perform miraculous signs with it. Don't forget your staff, Moses. Wandered up to the bush as a shepherd, didn't he? And as he's going away again, God taps him on the shoulder and reminds him, yes, you are a shepherd, take the staff. From one kind of shepherd to another. Now, how did he get there? 3 years at college? Of course not. The full-blown Cornhill training course? With all the PT conferences added on? No. Afraid not. Hadn't been invented then. 80 years in God's school of life and one meeting with the God of the bush. Now, friends, we don't need a bush. Because this is our God. The God who calls us to himself calls us to serve him. And he's the God? Were the people with promises you can rely on? Don't you long to belong to this kind of God? He's the God with a heart. I have come down to rescue them. That's the God for me. The God with a name. I will be what I need to be for you in the circumstances. Grace can live with me where you cannot. It's the God with power. The will of God can never lead us where the power of God can't enable us. He made us. To tell him our weaknesses is not telling him what he doesn't know already. What's it like for you to live with the God of the bush? Oh Lord, please send someone else. Don't go there. Don't go there. Then we have to face the God with anger. But this is the God who's our God. What about you? I want to say thank you. What a God to have. Why don't we just have a moment or two of quiet? A moment for personal thanks. Maybe a moment as God's been putting his finger on us tonight, where we may need to bite our tongue on some of these, Lord, some send someone else's we might have uttered. A moment of quiet as we think of the confidence we can have with such a God as our God.